moment. Danny Miller's was cock of the walk, undoubtedly, and had been so for some time. It was 3 years since Danny had seen the inside, and unless he made a grievous error, it would be still longer before he did. Danny had come from America after serving his second sentence for burglary, and had brought with him a clever brain, a belief in organization that was typically American. The British practitioner is by nature an individualist, and a wholesome respect for British police methods. The result was that, though his minions slipped occasionally and served short sentences for their carelessness, Danny went free and successful, much too successful for the liking of the CID. Now, Danny had all the American crook's ruthlessness in dealing with an enemy. His habit was a gun, but he would think no more of sticking a knife into a man than he would of swatting the fly that annoyed him. Grant thought that he would invite Danny to come and see him. Meanwhile, there was the packet on his table. Eagerly he opened it, and eagerly skipped the slightly prosy unimportances with which it opened. Bretherton, of the scientific side, was inclined to be a pompous dogmatist. If you sent him a Persian cat to report on, he would spend the first sheet of foolscap in deciding that its coat was grey and not fawn, and picked out the salient thing. Just above the junction of the handle with the blade, Bretherton said, was a stain of blood which was not the blood on the blade. The base on which the saint stood was hollow and had been broken at one side. The break was merely a cut which did not gape and was almost invisible owing to the blood stain. But when the surface was pressed, one edge of the rough cut was raised very slightly above the other. In gripping the tool, the murderer had made the fracture in the metal gape sufficiently to injure his own hand. He would now be suffering from a jagged cut somewhere on the thumb side of the first finger of the left hand, or finger side of the thumb. Good so far, thought Grant, but one can't sift London for a left-handed man with a cut hand and arrest him for that. He sent for Williams. "Do you know where Danny Miller is living now?" he asked. "No, sir," said Williams. "But Barber will know. He came up from Newbury last night, and he knows all about Danny." "All right, go and find out." "No, better send Barber to me." When Barber came, a tall, slow man with a sleepy and misleading smile, he repeated his question. "Danny Miller?" Barber said. "Yes, he has rooms in a house in Amber Street, Pimlico." "Oh, been very quiet lately, hasn't he?" "So we thought, but I think that jewel robbery that the Gowbridge people are busy with now is Danny. I thought banks were his line." "Yes, but he has a new Jane. He probably wants money."
"I see. Do you know his number?"
Barber did. An hour later, Danny, who was performing a leisurely and painstaking toilet in the room in Amber Street, was informed that Inspector Grant would be very much obliged if he would have a short talk with him at the yard. Danny's pale grey, wary eyes surveyed the plain-clothes man who had brought the message.
"If he thinks he has anything on me," he said, "he has another guest coming."
The plain-clothes man did not think that the inspector wanted anything but some information from him.
"Oh, and what is the inspector inspecting at the moment?"
But that the plain-clothes man either did not know or would not tell.
"All right," said Danny. "I'll be along right now."
When a portly constable led him into Grant's presence, Danny, who was small and slim, indicated the departing one with a backward jerk of the head and a humorous lift of an eyebrow.
"It isn't often anyone troubles to announce me," he said.
"No," said Grant, smiling.
"Your presence is usually announced after your departure, isn't it? You're a wit, Inspector. I shouldn't have thought you'd need anyone to jog your brains along. You don't think you've got anything on me, do you?"
"Not at all. I thought you might be of some use to me."
"You're certainly flattering."
It was impossible to tell when Miller was serious or otherwise. "Did you ever know by sight a man like this?" While he described in detail the murdered man, Grant's eyes were examining Danny and his brain was busy with what his eyes saw. Gloves. How could he get the glove off Danny's left hand without deliberately asking for its removal? When he came to the end of his description, particularized even to the turned-in toe, Danny said politely, "That's the deader from the queue." "No, I'm very sorry to disappoint you, Inspector, but I never saw the man in my life." "Well, I suppose you have no objections to coming with me and having a look at him?" "Not if it'll set your mind at rest, Inspector. I'll do anything to oblige." The inspector put his hand into his pocket and brought it out full of coins, as if to make sure of his loose change before setting out. A sixpenny piece slid through his fingers and rolled swiftly across the smooth surface of the table towards Miller, and Miller's hand shot out in an abrupt preventive movement as it was about to drop off the table's edge to the floor. He fumbled for a moment with his gloved hand and then laid the coin down on the table. "Trifling things, these," he remarked in his flat, amiable voice. But it was his right hand that he had used to stop it. As they were driving down to the mortuary in a car, he turned to the inspector with the almost noiseless expulsion of breath that in him did duty for a laugh. "Say," he said, "if any of my pals see me now, they'll all be boarding a dangler for Southampton inside 5 minutes and not waiting to pack." "Well, we'd do the packing back," said Grant. "Got us all taped like that, have you? Would you bet on it? I'll lay you 5 to 1 in dollars. No, pounds. 5 to 1 in pounds that you don't have one of us settled inside 2 years. You won't take it? Well, I think you're wise." When Miller was brought face to face with the body of the murdered man, Grant's eager eyes could trace no shadow of expression on that poker face. Danny's cool grey glance wandered over the dead man's features in a half-interested indifference. And Grant knew certainly that even had Miller known the man, his hope of a betraying gesture or expression had been a vain one. "No," Danny was saying, "I never saw the man in my..." He stopped. There was a long pause. "Say, but I did," he said. "Oh, gosh, let me think. Where was it? Where was it? Wait a minute, and it'll come." He beat a hectic tattoo on his forehead with his gloved palm. Was this acting? Thought Grant. Good acting, if so. But then Miller would never make the mistake of acting badly. "Oh, gosh, I can't get it. I talked to him, too. Don't think I ever knew his name, but I'm sure I talked to him." In the end, Grant gave it up. He had the inquest in front of him, but it was more than Danny Miller did. The fact that his brain had gone back on him was an outrage in his eyes and quite insupportable. "I'll never forget a man," he kept saying, "any more than a bull does." "Well, you can think it over and telephone to me," said Grant. "Meanwhile, will you do one thing more for me? Will you take your gloves off?" Danny's eyes shut suddenly to bright slits. "What's the big idea?" he said. "Well, there isn't any reason that you shouldn't take them off, is there?" "How do I know that?" snapped Danny. "Look here," said Grant good-naturedly. "A minute ago you wanted a gamble. Well, here's one. If you take your gloves off, I'll tell you whether you've won or not, and if I lose..." "Well, I have no warrant, you know," and Grant smiled easily into the gimlet eyes boring into his own. Danny's eyelids lifted. His old nonchalance came back. He drew his right glove off and held out his hand. Grant glanced at it and nodded. Then he slipped off his left glove and extended his hand, and as he did so, the right hand went back into his coat pocket. The left hand that lay open to Grant's gaze was clean and unscarred. "You win, Miller," said Grant. "You're a sportsman," and the slight bulge in Danny's right-hand coat pocket disappeared. "You'll let me know the minute you have a brainwave, won't you?" Grant said as they parted, and Miller promised.
"Don't you worry," he said. "I don't let my brain go back on me and get away with it."
And Grant made his way to lunch and the inquest. The jury, having swallowed at one nauseating gulp the business of viewing the body, had settled into their places with that air of conscious importance and simulated modesty which belongs to those initiated into a mystery. Their verdict was already certain, therefore they had no need to worry themselves over the rights or wrongs of the case. They could give themselves up wholly to the delightful occupation of hearing all about the most popular murder of the day from lips of eyewitnesses. Grant surveyed them sardonically and thanked the gods that neither his case nor his life depended on their intelligences. Then he forgot them and gave himself up to the rich comedy of the witnesses. It was strange to compare the grim things that fell from their lips with the pretty comedy they themselves presented. He knew them so well by now, and they all ran so amusingly true to form. There was the constable, who had been on duty at the Woffington Pit queue, brushed and shining, his dampish forehead shining most of all. Precise in his report, and tremendously gratified by his own preciseness. There was James Ratcliffe, the complete householder, hating his unexpected publicity, rebelling against his connection with such an unsavoury affair, but determined to do his duty as a citizen. He was the type that is the law's most useful ally, and the inspector recognised the fact and mentally saluted him in spite of the fact that he had been unhelpful. Waiting in queues bored him, he said, and as long as the light was good enough, he had read, until the doors opened and the pressure became too great to do anything but stand. There was his wife, whom the inspector had last seen sobbing in her bedroom. She still clutched a handkerchief, and obviously expected to be encouraged and soothed after every second question. And she was subjected to a longer examination than anyone else. She was the one who had stood directly behind the dead man.
"Are we to understand, madam," said the coroner, "that you stood for nearly 2 hours in close proximity to this man, and yet have no recollection of him, or of his companions, if any?"
"But I wasn't next to him all that time. I tell you, I didn't see him until he fell over at my feet."
"Then who was next in front of you most of the time?"
"I don't remember. I think it was a boy, a young man."
"And what became of the young man?"
"I don't know."
"Did you see him leave the queue?"
"No."
"Can you describe him?"
"Yes, he was dark and foreign-looking, rather."
"Was he alone?"
"I don't know. I don't think so, somehow. I think he was talking to someone."
"How is it that you do not remember more distinctly what occurred when it is only 3 nights ago?"
The shock had put everything out of her head, she said.
"Besides," she added,
her gelatinous backbone ossified suddenly by the coroner's ill-hidden scorn,
"in a queue one doesn't notice the people next one. Both I and my husband were reading most of the time."
And she dissolved into hysterical weeping. Then there was the fat woman, shiny with satin and soap and water, recovered now from the shock and reluctance she had displayed at the crowded moment of the murder, and more than willing to tell her tale. Her plump red face and boot-button brown eyes radiated a grim satisfaction with her role. She seemed disappointed when the coroner thanked her and dismissed her in the middle of a sentence. There was a meek little man, as precise in manner as the constable had been, but evidently convinced that the coroner was a man of little intelligence. When that long-suffering official said,
"Yes, I was aware that queues usually go 2 by 2,
the jury allowed themselves to snigger, and the meek little man looked pained. as neither he nor the other three witnesses from the queue could recall the murdered man, nor throw any light on any departure from the queue, they were dismissed with scant attention. The doorkeeper, incoherent with pleasure at being so helpful, informed the coroner that he had seen the dead man before, several times. He had come quite often to the Woffington, but he knew nothing about him. He had always been well-dressed. No, the doorkeeper could not recall any companion, though he was sure that the man had not habitually been alone. The atmosphere of futility that characterized the inquest discouraged Grant. A man whom no one professed to know, stuck in the back by someone whom no one had seen. It was a sweet prospect. No clue to the murderer, except the dagger, and that told nothing except that the man was scarred on a finger or thumb. No clue to the murdered man, except the hope that a Faith Brothers employee might have known the person to whom he sold a fawn-patterned tie with faint pink splashes. When the inevitable verdict of murder against some person or persons unknown had been given, Grant went to a telephone, revolving in his mind the Ratcliffe woman's tale of a young foreigner. Was that impression a mere figment of her imagination, brought into being by the suggestion of the dagger? Or was it a genuine corroboration of his Dago theory? Mrs. Ratcliffe's young foreigner had not been there when the murder was discovered. He was the one who had disappeared from the queue, and the one who had disappeared from the queue had most certainly murdered the dead man. Well, he would find out from the yard if there was anything new, and if not, he would fortify himself with tea. He needed it. And the slow sipping of tea conduced to thought. Not the painful tabulations of Barker, that prince of superintendents, but the speculative revolving of things which he, Grant, found more productive. He numbered among his acquaintances a poet and essayist who sipped tea in a steady, monotonous rhythm, the while he brought to birth his masterpieces. His digestive system was in a shocking condition, but he had a very fine reputation among the more precious of the modern litterateurs. Chapter 4. Raoul Lagarde. But over the telephone Grant heard something which put all thoughts of tea out of his head. There was waiting for him a letter, addressed in capitals. Grant knew very well what that meant. Scotland Yard has a wide experience of letters addressed in capitals. He smiled to himself as he hailed a taxi. If people only realized that writing in capitals didn't disguise a hand at all, but he sincerely hoped they never would. Before he opened the letter that awaited him, he dusted it with powder and found it covered with fingerprints. He slit the top delicately, holding the letter, which was fat and softish, in a pair of forceps, and drew out a wad of Bank of England 5-pound notes and a half sheet of notepaper. On the notepaper was printed, "To bury the man who was found in the queue." There were 5 notes, £25. Grant sat down and stared. In all his time in the CID, a more unexpected thing had not happened. Somewhere in London tonight was someone who cared sufficiently for the dead man to spend £25 to keep him from a pauper's grave, but who would not claim him. Was this corroboration of his intimidation theory, or was it conscience money? Had the murderer a superstitious desire to do the right thing by his victim's body? Grant thought not. The man who stuck another in the back didn't care a hoot what became of the body. The man had a pal, man or woman, in London tonight, a pal who cared to the tune of £25. Grant called in Williams, and together they considered the plain, cheap, white envelope and the strong, plain capitals. "Well," said Grant, "what do you know?" "A man," said Williams, "not well off, not used to writing much, clean, smokes, depressed. Excellent, said Grant. You're no good as a Watson, Williams. You get away with all the kudos.
Williams, who knew all about Watson, at the age of 11 he had spent hunted moments in a hayloft in Worcestershire trying to read the speckled band without being discovered by authority, who had banned it, smiled and said,
I expect you've got far more out of it, sir.
But Grant had not.
Except that he's a poor hand at the business. Fancy sending anything as easily traced as English £5 notes.
He blew the light soft powder over the half-sheet of notepaper, but found no fingerprints. He summoned a constable and sent the precious envelope and the bundle of notes to have all fingerprints photographed. The sheet of notepaper, bearing the printed message, he sent to the handwriting expert.
Well, the banks are shut now, worse luck. Are you in a hurry to get back to the missus, Williams?
No, Williams was in no hurry. His missus and the baby were in Southend with his mother-in-law for a week.
In that case, Grant said, we'll dine together, and you can give me the benefit of your ideas on the subject of murders in queues.
Some years before, Grant had inherited a considerable legacy, a legacy sufficient to have permitted him to retire into idle nonentity, if such had been his desire. But Grant loved his work, even when he swore and called it a dog's life, and the legacy had been used only to smooth and embroider life until what would have been the bleak places were eliminated, and to make some bleak places in other lives less impossible. There was a little grocer's shop in a southern suburb, bright as a jewel with its motley goods, which owed its existence to the legacy, and to Grant's chance meeting with a ticket-of-leave man on his first morning out. It was Grant who had been the means of putting him away, and it was Grant who provided the means of his rehabilitation. It was owing entirely to the legacy, therefore, that Grant was an habitué of so exclusive an eating-place as Laurence, and a much more astonishing and impressive fact, a pet of the head waiter's. Only 5 persons in Europe are pets of Laurent's head waiter, and Grant was thoroughly conscious of the honour and thoroughly sensible of the reason. Marcel met them halfway down the green and gold room, with his face screwed to an expression of the most excruciating sorrow. He was desolated, but there was not a table worthy of Monsieur left. There were no tables at all except that much-to-be-condemned one in that corner. Monsieur had not let him know that he was to be expected. He was desolated, desolated, simply. Grant took the table without a murmur. He was hungry, and he did not care where he ate so that the food was good, and except for the fact that the table was directly outside the service door, there was no fault to be found with it. A couple of green draught screens camouflaged the door, and the door, being a swing one, kept the rattle of crockery to a faint castagnette music that blossomed every now and then in a sudden fortissimo as the door swung wide and closed again. Over their dinner, Grant decided that in the morning Williams should visit the banks in the area indicated by the letter's postmark, and with that as a basis, track down the history of the banknotes. It shouldn't be difficult. Banks were always accommodating. From that, they turned to the discussion of the crime itself. It was Williams' opinion that it was a gang affair, that the dead man had fallen foul of his gang, had known his danger, had borrowed the gun from the only friendly member of the crowd, and had never had a chance to use it. The money that had arrived tonight had come from the secretly friendly one. It was a good enough theory, but it left out things. Why had he no identification marks on him, then?
Perhaps, said Williams with electrifying logic. It's a gang habit, no identification if they're caught.
That was a possible theory, and Grant was silent for a little, thinking it over. It was with the entree that he became conscious, with that sixth sense which 4 years of the Western Front and many more in the CID had developed to an abnormal acuteness, that he was being watched.
Restraining the impulse to turn round, he was sitting with his back to the room, almost facing the service door. He glanced casually into the mirror, but no one seemed to be taking the slightest interest in him. Grant continued to eat, and in a moment or two tried again. The room had emptied considerably since their arrival, and it was easy to examine the various people in the vicinity, but the mirror showed only a collection of self-absorbed people eating, drinking, and smoking. And still Grant had that sense of being subjected to a long scrutiny. It made his flesh creep, that steady, unseen examination. He lifted his eyes above William's head to the screen that hid the door, and there, in the chink between the screens, were the eyes that watched him. As if conscious of his discovery, the eyes wavered and disappeared, and Grant went serenely on with his meal. A too curious waiter, he thought. Probably knows who I am, and just wanted to gape at anyone connected with a murder. Grant had suffered much from the gapers, but presently, looking up in the middle of a sentence, he found the eyes back at their examination of him. This was too much. He stared stolidly in return. But the owner of the eyes was evidently unaware that he was visible at all to Grant, and continued his watching uninterrupted. Now and then, as a waiter came or went behind the screen, the eyes disappeared, but always they returned to their furtive gazing. Grant was seized with a desire to see this man, whose interest in himself was of so absorbing a character. He said to Williams, who was seated not more than a yard in front of the screen, "There is someone at the back of the screen behind you who is taking a most abnormal interest in us. When I click my fingers, fling back your right hand and knock the screen sideways. Make it look as much like an accident as you can." Grant waited until the waiter traffic had lulled for a little, and the eyes were steady at gaze, and then gently snapped his middle finger and thumb. William's brawny arm shot out. The screen quivered for a moment and collapsed sideways. But there was no one there. Only the agitated swinging of the door showed where someone had made his hasty exit. "Well, that's that," thought Grant, as Williams was apologizing for the accident with the screen. "You can't identify a pair of eyes." He finished his dinner without further annoyance and strolled back to the yard with Williams, hoping that the photographs of the prints on the envelope would be ready for his examination. No photographs had come, but there was a report on the tie which had been sent to Faith Brothers' factory at Northwood. The only consignment of that pattern of tie sent out in the last year was a box of six in various shades which had been sent as a repeat order at the request of their Nottingham branch. They returned the tie and hoped that if they could be of any further use, the inspector would command them. "If nothing important turns up between now and tomorrow," said Grant, "I shall go down to Nottingham while you are doing the banks." And then a man came in with photographs of the envelope prints, and Grant took from his desk the photographs of the other prints in the case, the prints of the dead man's fingertips and the prints found on the revolver. Nothing but smudges, the report said, had been found on any of the banknotes, so Grant and the sergeant applied themselves to the examination of the envelope prints. A variety of impressions were apparent, since several people had handled the envelope since the writer had posted the letter. But clear and perfect, and without possibility of doubt, was the print of a forefinger to the right of the flap, and the forefinger was the same forefinger that had left its mark on the revolver found in the dead man's pocket. "Well, that fits your theory about the friend who supplied the gun, doesn't it?" said Grant. But the sergeant made a queer, choked noise and continued to look at the print. "What's the matter? It's as clear as a kid's alphabet." The sergeant straightened himself and looked queerly at his superior. "I'll swear I hadn't a glass too much, sir. But it's either that or the whole fingerprint system is balmy.
Look at that. He pointed with a not-too-steady forefinger at a print in the extreme lower right-hand corner, and as he did so, he shoved the dead man's fingerprints, which had lain slightly apart, under Grant's nose. For a little there was silence, while the inspector compared the prints, and the sergeant, over his shoulder, half fearfully corroborated his previous view. But there was no getting away from the fact that faced them, in irrefutable whirls and ridges, the fingerprint was that of the dead man. It was only a moment or two before Grant realized the simple significance of that apparently staggering fact. "Communal notepaper, of course," he said offhandedly, while his looker-on half mocked at him for having allowed himself to be victimized even for a moment by the childish amazement that had overcome him. "Your theory blossoms, Williams. The man who lent the gun and provided the money lived with the dead man. That being so, of course, he can spin any kind of yarn he likes to his landlady, or his wife, or whoever would be interested about the disappearance of his chum." He took up the telephone on his desk. "We'll see what the handwriting people have to say about the piece of notepaper." But the handwriting experts had nothing to add to what Grant already knew or guessed. The paper was of a common type that could be bought at any stationer's or bookstore. The printing was that of a man. Given a specimen of a suspect's handwriting, they would probably be able to say whether or not the printing had been done by him, but so far they could be of no more help than already indicated. Williams departed to his temporarily bereaved home to comfort his uxorious mind by reminding himself how short a week was and how pretty Mrs. Williams would be when she came back from Southend, and Grant remained where he was, trying to mesmerize the dagger into giving up its tale. It lay on the dark green leather surface of his desk, a graceful, wicked, toy-like thing, its business end, in its slender viciousness, making a queer contrast to the bluff saint on the handle with his silly, expressionless face. Grant considered the saintly features sardonically. What was it Ray Markable had said? You'd want a blessing on an undertaking as big as that. Well, Grant thought, he would choose a more potent saint as O.C. affairs than the ineffectual holy one on the handle. His thoughts went to Ray Markable. This morning's press had been full of her projected departure for America, the popular papers expressing themselves in lamentation, and the more highbrow in bitterness and indignation that British managers should allow the best musical comedy star of a generation to leave the country. Should he go to her, Grant wondered, before she left, and ask her bluntly why she had looked surprised at the description of the dagger? There had been nothing to connect her, even remotely, with the crime. He knew her history, the little semi-detached villa in a dreary suburb that she had called home, the council school she had attended, her real name, which was Rosie Markham. He had even met Mr. and Mrs. Markham over the affair of the suitcase. It was exceedingly unlikely that she could throw any light on the Kew murder, and it was still more unlikely that she would if she could. She had had her chance to be frank with him over that tea in her dressing-room, and she had quite deliberately kept him outside any knowledge she might have had. That knowledge, of course, might be entirely innocent. Her surprise might have been due to recognition of the dagger's description, and yet have nothing to do with the murder. The dagger was far from unique, and many people must have seen and handled similar weapons. No, either way he was not likely to get much satisfaction from another interview with Miss Markable. She would have to depart for the United States uninterrogated. With a sigh for its unproductiveness, he locked the dagger away in its drawer again, and set off for home. He came out onto the embankment to find that it was a fine night with a light, frosty mist in the air, and he decided that he would walk home. The midnight streets of London, always so much more beautiful than the choppy, crowded ones of the daytime, fascinated him. At noon,
London made you a present of an entertainment, rich and varied and amusing. But at midnight she made you a present of herself. At midnight you could hear her breathe. When at length he turned into the road where he lived, he had come to the stage of walking automatically, and a starry mist possessed his brain. For a little while, Grant had shut his eyes, but he was not asleep, actually or metaphorically, and the eyes of his brain opened with a start at the dim figure that was waiting on the opposite corner just outside the lamplight. Who was hanging about at this hour? He debated rapidly whether or not to cross and walk down the other side of the street, and so come within criticizing distance of the figure. But it was rather late to change his direction. He held on, ignoring the loiterer. Only when he was turning in at his own gate, he looked back. The figure was still there, almost indistinguishable in the gloom. It was after 12 when he let himself in with his latchkey, but Mrs. Field was waiting up for him.
"I thought you'd like to know that there has been a gentleman here asking for you. He wouldn't wait, and he wouldn't leave a message."
"How long ago was that?" "More than an hour," Mrs. Field said. She didn't see him rightly. He had stood well out beyond the step, but he was young.
"No name?"
No, he had refused to give a name. "All right," said Grant. "You go to bed. If he comes back, I'll let him in." She hesitated in the doorway.
"You won't do anything rash, will you?" she said solicitously. "I don't like the thought of you being here all alone with someone who might be an anarchist for all we know."
"Don't you worry, Mrs. Field. You won't be blown up tonight."
"It isn't blowing up I'm afraid of," she said. "It's the thought of you lying here, perhaps bleeding to death and no one knowing. Think how I'd feel when I came in the morning and found you like that."
Grant laughed. "Well, you can comfort yourself. There isn't the slightest chance of anything so thrilling happening. No one has ever spilt my blood except a Jerry at Contalmaison, and that was more by luck than good management." She conceded the point.
"See, and have a bite before you go to bed," she said,
indicating the food on the sideboard.
"I got some English tomatoes, and the beef is Tompkins' best pickled."
She said good night and went, but she could not have reached her kitchen before a knock sounded on the door. Grant heard her go to the door, and even while his brain was speculating about his visitor, the looker-on in him was wondering whether it was spunk or curiosity that had sent Mrs. Field so willingly to answer the knock. A moment later she threw open the sitting-room door and said,
"A young gentleman to see you, sir."
And into Grant's eager presence came a youth of 19 or 20, fairly tall, dark, broad-shouldered, but slight, and poised on his feet like a boxer. As he came forward, he shot a furtive glance from his brilliant dark eyes into the corner behind the door, and he came to a halt some yards from the inspector in the middle of the room, turning a soft felt hat in his slim gloved hands.
"You are Inspector Grant?" he asked.
Grant motioned him to a chair, and the youth, with a completely un-English grace, subsided sideways onto it, still clutching his hat, and began to talk.
"I saw you tonight at Laurent's. I am in the pantry there. I cleaned the silver and things like that. They told me who you were, and after, I think for a while, I decided to tell you all about it."
"A very good idea," said Grant. "Carry on. Are you Italian?"
"No, I am French. My name is Raoul Legarde."
"All right, carry on."
"I was in the queue the night the man was killed. It was my night off. For a long time I was standing next to the man. He trod on my foot in accident, and after that we talked a little about the play. I was on the outside and he was next the wall. Then a man come to talk to him and came in front of me. The man who was new wanted something from the other man. He stayed until the door opened and the people moved. He was angry about something,
They were not quarrelling, not as we quarrel, but I think they were angry. When the murder happened, I ran away. I did not want to be mixed up with the police. But tonight I saw you, and you looked gentil, and so I made up my mind to tell you all about it. Why didn't you come to Scotland Yard and tell me? I do not trust the Sûreté. They make very much out of nothing, and I have no friends in London. When the man came to talk to the man who was murdered and pushed you back a place, who was between you and the theatre wall? A woman in black. Mrs. Ratcliffe, so far the boy was telling the truth. Can you describe the man who came and went away again?
He was not very tall, not as tall as me. He had a hat like mine, only more brown, and a coat like mine.
He indicated his tight-fitting, wasted, navy-blue coat.
Only brown, too. He was very dark, without moustache, and these stuck out.
He touched his own beautifully modelled cheek and chin-bones. Would you know him again if you saw him?
Oh, yes.
Well enough to swear to?
What is that?
To take your oath on.
Oh, yes.
What did the two men quarrel about?
I don't know. I didn't hear. I was not deliberately listening, you understand. And though I speak English, I do not understand if people talk very quickly. I think the man who came wanted something that the man who was killed would not give him.
When the man went away from the queue, how is it that no one saw him go?
Because just then the policeman was walking down saying, "Stand back," to the people.
That was too glib. The inspector took out his notebook and pencil, and laying the pencil on the open page, held it out to his visitor. "Can you show me how you stood in the queue? Put marks for the people and label them." The boy stretched out his left hand for the book, took the pencil in his right hand, and made a very intelligent diagram, unaware that he had, at that moment, defeated the distrusted Sûreté's attempt to make something out of nothing. Grant watched his serious, absorbed face and thought rapidly. He was telling the truth, then. He had been there until the man collapsed, had backed with the others away from the horror, and had continued backing until he could walk away from the danger of being at the mercy of foreign police. And he had actually seen the murderer, and would recognize him again. Things were beginning to move. He took back the book and pencil that the boy extended to him, and as he raised his eyes from the consideration of the diagram, he caught the dark eyes resting rather wistfully on the food on the sideboard. It occurred to him that the guard had probably come straight from his work to see him. "Well, I'm very grateful to you," he said. "Have some supper with me now, before you go." The boy refused shyly, but allowed himself to be persuaded, and together they had a substantial meal of Mr. Tompkins' best pickled. Legarde talked freely of his people in Dijon, the sister who sent him French papers, the father who disapproved of beer since one ate grapes but not hops, of his life at Laurence and his impression of London and the English. And when Grant eventually let him out in the black stillness of the early morning, he turned on the doorstep and said apologetically and naively, "I am sorry now that I did not tell before. But you understand how it was. To have run away at first made it difficult, and I did not know that the police were so gentil." Grant dismissed him with a friendly pat on the shoulder, locked up, and picked up the telephone receiver. When he was through, he said, "Inspector Grant speaking, this to be sent to all stations. Wanted, in connection with the London Queue murder, a left-handed man, about 30 years of age, slightly below middle height, very dark in complexion and hair, prominent cheek and chin bones, clean-shaven. When last seen was wearing a soft brown hat and tight-fitting brown coat. Has a recent scar on the left forefinger or thumb." And then he went to bed. Chapter 5.
Danny again. Running out of Marylebone into the sunlight of the morning, Grant looked out of his carriage window and felt more optimistic than he had since he had first interviewed the officials at Gow Street police station. The murderer had ceased to be a mythical being. They had a full description of him now, and it could only be a matter of time before they ran him down. And perhaps by tonight he would have settled the identity of the murdered man. He stretched his legs in the empty compartment and let the sun slide slowly back and fore over them as the train wheeled in its progress. A pleasant country, England, at 10 of a bright morning. Even the awful little suburban villas had lost that air of aggressiveness born of their inferiority complex, and were shining self-forgetful and demure in the clear light. Their narrow, inhospitable doors were no longer ugly in the atrociousness of cheap paint and appliqué mouldings. They were entrances of jade and carnelian and lapis lazuli and onyx into particular separate heavens. Their gardens with their pert, ill-dressed rows of tulips and meagre seed-sown grass were lovely as ever the hanging gardens of Babylon had been. Here and there a line of gay motley child's clothes danced and ballooned with the breeze in a necklace of coloured laughter. And farther on, when the last vestiges of the town fell away, the wide acres of the grass country smiled broadly in the sunlight like an old hunting print. All England was lovely this morning, and Grant knew it. Even Nottingham canals had a Venetian touch of blue today, and their grimy, imprisoning walls were rosy as Petra. Grant came out of the station into the drone and clamour of trams. If he had been asked what represented the Midlands in his mind, he would unhesitatingly have said trams. Trams in London always seemed to him alien incongruities. Poor provincials who had been inveigled to the metropolis and drudged out a misanthropic and despised existence because they had never made enough money to get out of it. Grant never heard the faraway peculiar sing of an approaching tramcar without finding himself back in the dead, airless atmosphere of the Midland town where he had been born. The Midlanders did not hide away their trams in back streets. They trailed them proudly through their chiefest thoroughfares, partly from braggadocio, partly from a misplaced idea of utility. A long yellow string of them stood in Nottingham marketplace, blocking the view of the wide, almost continental square, and making the passage from the pavement on one side to the stalls of the market on the other a most exhilarating game of hide-and-seek. But the natives, with that adaptability to circumstances, which is nature's greatest marvel, seemed to enjoy the hop-skip-and-jump business, and to find it not too dangerous to be indulged in. No one was killed during the time that Grant walked down the street, at any rate. At Faith Brothers, he produced the tie which had belonged to the dead man, and explained that he wanted to know whether anyone remembered selling it. The man at the counter had no recollection of the transaction, but summoned a colleague who was flipping a white and too flexible forefinger up and down the wall of cardboard boxes in an endeavour to find an article that would meet with his customer's approval. Something told Grant that in matters sartorial this youth would have the memory of an oldest inhabitant, and he was right. After one glance at the tie, he said that he had taken it out of the window, or one exactly like it, for a gentleman about a month ago. The gentleman had seen it in the window, and because it matched the suit he was wearing, had come in and bought it. No, he did not think that he was a Nottingham man. Why? Well, he didn't talk Nottingham for one thing, and he didn't dress Nottingham for another. Could he describe the man? He could, and did, with minuteness and accuracy. "I can tell you the date if you like," said this surprising youth. "I remember because—" He hesitated, and finished with a refreshing lapse from his worldly wise air to a pink naivete. "Because of something that happened that day. It was the 2nd of February." Grant noted the date and asked what his impression of the stranger had been. Was he a commercial traveller? The youth thought not. He didn't talk business, and he didn't seem interested in the growth of Nottingham or anything. Grant asked if there was anything on in the town on that date that would bring a stranger to Nottingham, and the youth said yes, most emphatically. There had been a huge musical festival, a festival for all the Midlands, and there had been a good few people from London, too. He knew because he himself had taken part in it. He sang in a church choir and knew all about festivals. The stranger had looked much more like someone interested in the festival than a commercial traveller. He had thought at the time that that was probably what the man was in Nottingham for. Grant thought it was quite likely. He remembered the man's sensitive hands, and he had been an habitué of the Woffington, which, if not highbrow, is at least invariably musical. It didn't march with the gang theory, but he could not afford to ignore it because of that. The gang theory had no support in fact. It was a theory and nothing else, pure speculation. He thanked the youth and asked for the name of someone in Nottingham who would know all about the festival and the people who came to it. The youth said that he had better go and see Udall, the solicitor. Udall wasn't the secretary, but he was a sort of chairman, and it was his hobby. He sat there from morning to night, all the 3 days of the festival, and he would be certain to know anyone who was interested enough to come from London for it. Grant wrote down Udall's address, conscious that the youth's inquisitive mind was docketing him as it had docketed the dead man, and that years hence, if someone asked him to describe the man who took Udall's address, he would do it faithfully. He was wasted in a hatter's and hosier's.
"Are you looking for the man who bought the tie?"
the youth asked. He said, "looking," in inverted commas, giving it its police sense. "Not exactly," said Grant, "but I want to trace him if I can." And he departed to interview Mr. Udall. In a little side street, near the castle, the kind of street that has never seen a tram car, and where one's footsteps echo until one involuntarily looks behind, were situated the small and gloomy offices of Udall, Lister and Udall. 300 years old they were, and the waiting room was panelled in oak that extinguished the last valiant ray of light as it fought its way past the old greenish glass of the window-pane. The light died on the window-sill as the last survivor of a charge dies on the enemy parapet, murdered but glorious. But Mr. Udall, of Udall, Lister and Udall, would have considered it heresy if it had been suggested that things might be otherwise. Otherwise? That meant a building like a meat safe, fretted with windows until the walls were practically non-existent. A collection of plate glass, bound together by pilasters of an incredible ignobility. That was modern architecture. But, as if to make up for the dim dustiness of his surroundings, Mr. Udall himself beamed and shone and welcomed all humanity with that sublime lack of suspicion which makes friends and confidence men, but never lawyers. Being the only Udall of the third generation, he had been given in his youth a cupboard-like corner in the warren of small rooms that were the Udall offices, and since he loved oak panelling and beams and greenish glass, second only to symphonies and sonatas, he had stayed there. And now he was Udall, Lister and Udall, though a competent clerk kept anything too awful from happening. To say that Mr. Udall welcomed the inspector is an inadequate statement. Grant felt that he must have met the man before and have forgotten it. He betrayed none of the curiosity that was usually rampant on a man's face when the inspector followed his card into a room. Grant was to him merely another charming fellow being, and almost before he had made his business clear, Grant found himself being led away to lunch. It was so much nicer to talk over a meal, and it was long after one, and if the inspector hadn't eaten since breakfast, he must be famishing. Grant followed his unexpected host meekly enough. He had not yet got his information, and this seemed to be the only way of getting it. Moreover, a detective officer never throws away the chance of making an acquaintance. If Scotland Yard has a motto, it is, "You never know." Over lunch, he learned that Mr. Udall had never, to his knowledge, seen the man he was looking for. He knew by sight or personally all the performers at the festival, as well as a great number of those merely interested in it, but none tallied exactly with the description Grant furnished.
"If you think he was musical, try Lyons Orchestra or the Picture Houses. Their orchestra performers are mostly Londoners."
Grant did not bother to explain that the supposition that the man was musical had arisen only through his supposed connection with the festival. It was easier and pleasanter to let Mr. Udall talk. In the afternoon, however, after he had taken farewell of his cheerful host, he did sift the various orchestra in the town with the lack of success that he had foreseen. He then telephoned to the yard to find out how Williams had fared in his hunt after the history of the banknotes, and spoke to Williams himself, who had just come back after a long morning's work. The notes were with the bank just now. Nothing had transpired so far, but they were on a scent, and the bank were working it. "Well," thought Grant, as he hung up the receiver, "one end of the tangle seemed to be working out slowly but surely. Nothing left so clear and incontrovertible a history behind it as a Bank of England note, and if he had failed at Nottingham to trace the dead man himself, their discovery of the friend's identity would inevitably lead them to the knowledge of who the dead man was, and from the dead man to the Dago would be only a step. Still, he was slightly depressed. He had had such a hunch this morning that before night an unexpected piece of information would have set him on the right track, that he surveyed his wasted day with something like disgust, and not even the after-effects of the good lunch Mr. Udall had given him, nor the rosy afterglow of that gentleman's goodwill to men, were sufficient to comfort him. At the station he found that he had half an hour to wait for his train, and he betook himself to the lounge of the nearest hotel in the vague hope of picking up unconsidered trifles of information in that most gossipy of all public places. He surveyed the two waiters with a jaundiced eye. One was supercilious and like an overfed pug, and the other was absent-minded and like a dachshund. Grant felt instinctively that help was not in them. But the person who brought him his coffee was a charming middle-aged waitress. Grant's weary soul brightened at the sight of her. In a few minutes he was indulging in a friendly, if disjointed, exchange of generalities, and when she went away temporarily to attend to the wants of someone else, she always came back and hovered within speaking distance until the conversation was resumed. Realizing that a verbal description of a man who was not a hunchback or blind or otherwise abnormal would convey nothing to this woman, who saw in one day at least half a dozen men who might have fitted a description of the dead man, Grant contented himself with giving leads which might provoke useful information of a relative sort. "You're quiet here just now," he said. Yes, she admitted, this was their quiet time. They had slack times and busy ones. It just happened like that. Did it depend on the number of people staying in the hotel? No, not always, but usually it did. The hotel was the same. They had slack times and busy ones. Was the hotel ever full up? Yes, it had been full to bursting when the cooperative came, the whole 200 rooms. It was the only time she remembered such a crowd in Nottingham. "When was that?" asked Grant.
"At the beginning of February," she said. "They come twice a year, though."
At the beginning of February. Where did the cooperative people come from? From all over the Midlands. Not from London? No, she thought not, but some of them might have. Grant went to catch his train, revolving the new possibility, and not finding it acceptable, though he was not quite sure why. The dead man had not looked that type. If he had been a shop assistant, it had been in a business.